And what are you doing here now besides enjoying the skiing?
First of all, skis need wax.
Somebody's dead.
It's getting serious on this track, fam.
You go by, you read some obscure passage, and then pretend you pawn it off as your own idea just to impress some girls. Paris, my friend.
That's the great thing about sports. You play to win. And I don't care if you don't have any wins. You go play to win.
Then strong competition and head-to-head competition.
Get back.
Here it is. The season's on the line. Two receivers left and right. McCown takes the snap. He steps up. He's all by himself. Fires into the end zone. Caught. Touchdown. No. No. The Cardinals have knocked the Vikings out of the playoffs.
My groove scraper is this beauty.
Yep. It's made with bits of real banther. So you know it's good.
I hate this.
It's quite pungent.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, it's a formidable scent. It stings the nostrils.
In a good way.
Yeah. But it works.
Brian, I'm going to be honest with you. That smells like pure gasoline.
They've done studies, you know. 60% of the time, it works every time.
That does make sense.
I love
special 5mm flavor for special people. Special edition 5mm Red Creek scrapers for special people like you.
Special people like you and me, if you are interested in this podcast and its topics, you are probably kind of a special person. This is the Cedar Skier Podcast. This is episode 2. We got a lot of great things we're going to talk about on the show. By the way, was that live discussion of Will Ferrell in Zach Caldwell's waxing room? Because it kind of seemed like it was. Caldwell's scraping, waxing, and Will Ferrell was kind of mentioning back and forth, you know, this is pungent, it stings the nostrils, but it works, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the goal of those clips, Ryan.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. It seemed like it. That's Ralph, by the way, our interim producer. Ralph, are you aware, by the way, that we got some complaints, I shouldn't say complaints, but we got some letters from people about the show, the first show, and some people were wondering if you were even a real person.
You know, in this age of being offended by everything, I feel like I ought to be offended by that, but I'm just going to put that one aside.
Okay? Sure. Yeah, good idea. Well, good on you. We're going to get to it because we're starting out the show with a cool segment. We're going to do a little bit of Q&A. We've got emails and responses and questions from people all over the globe, and we're going to read them on the air here.
Oh, shoot. I don't have the sounder for this segment yet. Ready, Ryan.
Well, you wonder why you're still interim. So this is coming from Gavin from Baxter, Minnesota. Gavin from Baxter, Minnesota. He says, hello, Ryan. Just wondering, is Ralph a real person? The sound bites were heavy and stupid the first 9 minutes of the show, and then they pretty much disappeared for the next 70 minutes. He's either fake or a really bad producer. Which is it? Ralph, are you real? What do you have to say about that?
I don't know how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal.
Really?
Right.
People know me.
Well, I'm very happy for you.
Well, I think that answers that question. So let's get on to another one here. This one's from Mark from Avon, Colorado, a local. Nice. He says, one second here. He says, Ryan, I listened to the show yesterday, and I couldn't help also share in your dismay that the cancellation of both the Snow Mountain Stampede and the Rabbit Ears Pass took place because of COVID-19. Very bummed. Yes, I was as well. However, that was pretty much the only part of the show that I liked. Wow, shots fired here. Ralph, do we have any positive feedback things? Because I'd rather read those first, if I could. I mean, just getting started here, one episode in. Gotta build my confidence.
Ryan, you're fine.
Okay, He goes on. Where was I? I did not. That was a. Okay. He says, this is Mark Avon, Colorado, our local, supporting the show. First, you went way too long. You spent 30 minutes talking about your own race that you competed in and three other people. No one cares. And then you spent 45 minutes talking about a book written by an animator, and it had nothing to do with skiing.
No!
Wow. I disagree. Okay, if you want to go back, listen to our show. We talked a little bit, about some 100K efforts, right? Fine. Talked about my own race, but seriously, guys, it was the only race that was happening in the entire world. So it was technically a race.
You know, Ron, I think this guy's got some advice for you.
Sure, what do you got?
Okay. My best advice to you? Yeah. Shut up.
I was waiting for that one.
You're welcome. Appreciate it. You're welcome.
Well, can I give him some advice? Get your own radio station. Get your own radio show.
Exactly. You don't like it? Get your own show.
Perfect. Mark, you know what I think about that? And there's me living out the topics from my last podcast about constructive criticism and how I handle it.
Well, you're the next big thing. Next big thing. iHeart podcast, right? That's the goal.
Sure. Sure is. Okay, so where were we? Emily from Mars Hill is the next one I wanted to read. Emily from Mars Hill says, Ryan, how do you make your skis fast? Good question. Well, first of all, see, this is why you're the worst producer. You really are. You fell asleep again.
First of all, skis need wax.
Thank you. First of all, they do need wax. Now, Emily, the other thing you got to consider, wax isn't everything when it comes to ski speed, right? But wax, scrape, that's the old adage that the more you're doing that, the faster your skis are going to be. Of course, it's probably the best to kind of set aside a pair of skis for each condition. And if you only have one, it can't be totally fast in every type of condition. So you got to make a choice if you want to set up your grind and based on, obviously, what kind of snow you typically are skiing on. If you're in the, well, obviously you're in Maine, so in New England, it's going to be a little bit different than if you're in the Rockies versus if you're in the Midwest, the snow types, or way out the Pacific Northwest, the snow types you're going to see. But I would recommend setting up your, based again, three things here, right? So.
If I want to explain it to you,
yeah,
I would.
So ski speed is three things, depending on three things. You've got the camber of the ski. That's big, and it needs to match, obviously, the weight of the skier and then the type of snow you've got, whether it's really firm, really soft. You've got the base material of the ski. That's huge. You've got the grind, which that kind of, I guess I kind of grouped that in with base material, too. But the grind is big. And then the wax is kind of the last thing that you're really dealing with. So that's why it's important that you have skis for different conditions, at least. That way you can have...
I'm not prepared. I really am not.
Well, I wasn't really prepared for that question. Okay, I read it. You handed it to me 5 seconds ago. Okay, so sorry it's taking me a while. Anyway, that's why it's important. If you have multiple skis, you're going to just have faster skis on any given day because base and camber are probably more influential than wax, at least in most conditions. Really wet and sloppy stuff, sometimes there's a really killer wax that's going to make a really big difference. For your average skier going out each day, that's what I would say. Okay, we should try and transition here to some really important things because the other feedback that I got was, it took a while. Well, actually, some people were saying, hey, I really want to hear what you talk about with the strength weight stuff, and I never got to it. So today, would like to do that, and I think I'm a little bit more ready. So I think we should just, let's just go right to it. You know, we're going to dive in. This topic, pretty close to my heart, actually. I've been working pretty hard on it. This is an inside scoop look at what will be, hopefully, my master's thesis being defended this spring. And the topic is upper body and lower body strength and power scaled allometrically to body mass and how that influences double pole performance on flats and inclines. And if that seems like a mouthful, we're going to kind of back up and get to it. But basically, the best way I like to think about it, if you're a sports person who's following endurance sports, think cycling first because you've probably heard, if you've seen any cycling event on TV or even just talk to a cyclist, you often hear about power to weight ratio. and how you want to improve your power to weight ratio. And you see this a lot in the Tour de France, because as they approach the Alps and climbing becomes really influential, you hear a lot about how light a cyclist is and yet how much power they are putting out. And we hear stuff like, what, is 6 kilograms per watt or something? That's kind of an insane elite standard for cyclists. Now, I feel like I got to look that up. I don't want to say something preposterous. Okay, so I had it backwards. Right. So what we're looking at, watts per kilo. That's the measurement. So actually, this is a great cyclinganalytics.com. They have a blog, and we can kind of compare what typically you would see at the different levels of cycling. So a world-class cyclist, their maximal power output in watts per kilograms at different time frames of exercise. Here we got a 5-second burst, a 1 minute, a 5 minute, and then for an hour. And their hour is 5.51 watts a kilo. 5 minutes, you're looking at 6.88. So that 5 minute number is probably the one where you're talking about, you know, when they make a move in the Tour de France. And I know sometime in between what time trial would be the 5.51, more in that range. But if they're making a burst, to be 6.8. I've heard 6 watts a kilo on moves on an uphill or an uphill time trial. Now, here's how crazy it'll drop down. Even an excellent cyclist, so that would be someone who's Cat 1. I kind of read this chart a little bit wrong. Actually, the ranges are a little bit different. So really, we're looking at, the world-class cyclist is going to be somewhere between 6.8 and 7.6 for a 5 minute, and they're going to be somewhere between 5.78 and 6.4 for the FTP. But still, you kind of get the general idea. Even just going down, like, I'm probably a Category 4 cyclist at best. On my best day, maybe a Category 3. Category 4. We'll just stay there. So you're looking at, 3.2 to 3.5 watts a kilo for the FT. And even for only 5 minutes, I might be able to hold 3.15 to 3.67. So that's just crazy. Untrained non-racer, 2.3 to 2.8. So anyway, those are just some numbers thrown at you. But the point of the pick is to paint a picture where you're looking at cyclists. That's a metric they use a lot with performance. They want to know, how much power can I put out and remain light? And there's a reason for that. And the reason is because the thing preventing speed, or the thing resisting that the cyclist is trying to overcome when you're going uphill, is primarily gravity. And gravity is obviously connected to body mass. So having an advantageous power to weight ratio on the uphills is really critical. Now, a time trialist in cycling, you'll notice, or even sprinters, they're not as concerned about that ratio, because the primary concern in terms of what they're trying to overcome to be faster is not just friction against the ground or resisting, and there's really no gravity. It's more surface area related, and it's been shown it's more advantageous to have more mass and more muscle, even in relation to the increase in surface area that you get because of that. So how does that tie into what we're talking about here and our study? Well, let's think about it. So when we are discussing any speed-related sport, the thing we must overcome to improve speed are these mechanical forces, the resistive forces. So we have gravity, we have friction, and we have air resistance. And we overcome them with our force production. So force production now is dependent in endurance sports upon muscle type. You have the SSC.
You know the thing.
Okay, I deserve that one. Okay, stretch shortening cycle. Say that like 100 times in a row. Anyway, stretch shortening cycle. Aerobic and anaerobic energy systems, that's obviously going to play a role in your force production, and skiing, cycling, and running. And also in those events, even running now, equipment is also something to think about in terms of force production. If you have a stiffer pole or your lower brackets and your bike, the frame are stiff, you're going to be able to put more force right into the pedals. Or I guess it's going to kind of, it's going to respond differently. Anyway, I guess that's not impacting the force from you, but it is the force going into the ground that's the propulsive force. So when we consider these resistive forces, we also have to consider the different elements of our body which are directly interacting with them. So let's take friction, for example. Friction, our body mass, the equipment we're using, and then the surface that we're on is going to have the most direct effect. And so when you're thinking about like a bike, there's not a lot of friction between the wheels and the road compared to, let's say, snow and a ski. Going back to that question that the listener asked, you know, talking about how do you make skis faster? Friction in skiing is huge, and it's dependent upon your conditions and all of that. So that's not necessarily tied to body mass, or at least I don't think it really should be, because if you're thinking about a ski and going back to its camber, and they're designed to interact with a skier's weight. So I theoretically, no matter what the conditions are, it's not like being heavier would have a distinct advantage in terms of friction. On a flat surface, right? The resistance to friction should be equalized, because if you're on a ski that fits your body mass, you're fine. You're on equal playing field with a heavier skier who also has a ski to match his body mass. And so friction, body mass is in there a little bit, but you're thinking more surface and the equipment there. Air resistance, this one is connected to the surface area of a human, right? The larger we are in terms of surface area, the more that air resistance will have a negative effect on producing speed. Gravity would be obviously our body mass. That's what that we're fighting against gravity. Body mass is going to be what holds us back, or what we're going to want to measure against, because it's the natural biological component that relates to it, that interacts with it. So now I guess my goal today, I just want to kind of give a little background on measuring strength and power research, and particularly as it's related to body mass, because I think hopefully that's going to explain why I'm headed in the direction in the world of Nordic ski research that I'd like to do. So we kind of got to start out, and by the way, if you want a little more in-depth and I'll say chronological layout of all this information as well, I did post up on our blog just the last 17 pages of my literature review, which talks specifically about strength-weight relationships in endurance sports research. And it goes all the way from the very beginning. It talks about all the stuff we're going to kind of mention here, but it gives you all the research, all the actual articles, summarizing them, connecting them, synthesizing those together. And it funnels you down to like, okay, here's where we're at with Nordic skiing. So if you want to take a look at that, it's a pretty lengthy, very thick read, but at least not the entire lit review, you know. Actually, it's kind of interesting. Every time you read these literature reviews, they're about skiing. Skiing specifically is what I've noticed, is they always get to start out with, you know, in the 1100s, you know, people up in the mountains in Russia started skiing. And it's like, do we really need the entire drawn out history of skiing to understand that we're going to be talking about, allometric scaling in upper body power and double pole performance? But, you know, so I did also copy this, and I kind of went overboard. My background official for this official lit review is very, very extensive, and it goes all the way back, and it really comes through. But I guess, you know, I found it interesting because it's a little bit like, I mean, could you be a Christian if you just read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John and understood that Jesus is Lord and he saved you from your sins and you didn't know anything about Moses? Yeah, but does learning about Moses in the Old Testament enrich your view and worship of God? You know, it's kind of like that. So there is my theological connection for today. Probably be the only one, but you never know. So anyway, the background is pretty extensive in terms of and it is definitely related in terms of ski speed and why we even arrived here in the first place. Like, the very fact that we're talking about double pole performance specifically, if 40 years ago, it might not have been that big a deal. But with the advent of new skis, with really firm grooming, and then different approaches to training, athletes have adapted. And that truly is, you know, it's come from striding on wood skis to now we're double poling on extremely light, very fast skis. And now courses have been adjusted accordingly. So now you're talking about incline and flats and their interaction and where, what parts of the course do skiers make up the most ground. And that all is related to what we get to. So, I will say that I kind of back up in my thesis. I start with that history and development of skiing, because talking just in general about the overview of classical techniques, and then, you know, diving into the importance and emergence of double pole technique specifically and how that's tied to the history and the development of other techniques, it does push you forward. And then I talk about the importance of skiing well on uphill terrain. And another huge heading, we talk about the determinants of double pole performance in general, which are ski speed, which equals cycle rate times cycle length. And in that section talks about pole force, cycle rates, joint kinematic characteristics, other determinants of double pole performance from the literature. We got gender, fatigue, equipment, technique, and skill. And that all builds to the next section about upper body strength and power. Because there's been tons of intervention related articles about those, you know, doing this improved upper body strength. That comes in the next section. We get to the involvement of the lower body and the upper body in the double pole technique. That is really, I found to be a very interesting portion of the research. Unfortunately, it sort of also tears apart my a research question by, I shouldn't say tears apart, but what it basically does is it says, you know, at the end of the day, even after we've researched this strength to weight relationship allometrically scaled, we still have to remember that double pull performance and upper body and lower body interaction is dependent on a lot of different things other than just sheer strength. You got energy metabolism, and that looks different between the upper body and lower body. Even in a single person, like, your upper body and lower body are metabolizing differently, and aerobic and anaerobic energy systems are different in the upper body and lower body. And if you're going to argue that the lower body is more activated on inclines, well, now you got to have to take that into consideration. You know, was it just lower body strength that changed the outcome at incline, or do we have to consider aerobic and anaerobic systems and bring that into the equation? So anyway, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself a little bit there, but anyway, I'm trying to set you up, I guess, if you want to read this post, where you'd be heading. The next section, we talk about specifically just the effect of incline on all the different techniques, but most specifically double poling. And then finally it gets to that body mass scaling section. So let's back up a little bit though. If you read that section and talking about body mass scaling, my goal today is just to give you a little background on the research and cycling and kind of connect it to skiing. So here we go. There are three ways to measure power. Okay, three ways we can scale it essentially. Absolutely, which would basically just be saying, this is the total power output or your total strength. You can use, the second way would be a standard ratio. So taking strength and then dividing it by weight. So that is what you see in cycling, power to weight ratio, strength to weight ratio. That's a standard ratio measurement. That is the most common thing we have seen in Nordic ski research in the last 25 years. They have used that measurement. And that's often what you see in cycling and, you know, when you're reading Velo news, but in the scientific literature, it's much more common now. The most recent stuff you're going to see allometrically used. And what allometric scaling is, it's the study of how processes scale with body size and with each other. Originally it's referring to the relationship between the size of a body part and the size of the body as a whole. And as both grow during development, now, applied to exercise science, well, maybe to explain, I'll just hop into, this is something I wrote in my thesis that can kind of help explain it. I say, recall that allometric scaling assumes geometric symmetry in mammals, suggesting power increases with body mass to the power of 0.67. So in other words, it's not one-to-one. As you grow in size, power doesn't increase on a one-to-one ratio. It's actually increased on a two-thirds ratio. And that's from research from 1992 and 2005. And actually interesting, now they're looking at, well, we got to be more specific. You know, can we direct the research to consider the size of muscles which are actually being used and develop these exponents based off of girth measurements? And so they've actually done that in soccer, some other sports, and really that's probably what you would need to do as well in skiing. Although think about how difficult that would be. What muscles are you going to choose in the double pull technique? So the layperson would be like, well, your arms, but it's so much more on the flat maybe, but again, prevailing research is showing that the lower body is proportionally more impactful even than the arms in terms of metabolic exertion as you double pull on the inclines. So probably that gives you an idea of kind of like what allometric scaling is at least. We saw in cycling where we started with this power to weight ratio, but you know, what exactly is that telling us? And what are the resistive forces that are at play in cycling? Can we just take them and compare them to skiing? I had a great discussion this morning, skiing on a massive golf course, ran into my friend Chris and he kind of said, you know, I'm not sure if you can just take that from what you see in cycling and apply it to skiing. And his point was bringing up the whole idea of not only courses and uphills and downhills, and specifically downhills, but if you're on a very, well, basically getting back to like, what is the ultimate mechanical resistance to speed? And it's like friction becomes very much at play in skiing, more so than cycling, or at least it's more unpredictable and very different. Connecting that to where gravity, yes, we're both going uphill, now gravity's at play, but in skiing, you've got more going on. And friction is the big one there. I would argue here, though, that, again, the direction of this research is we're taking a very specific element of ski racing, and that is flat double poling and incline double poling. And we're going to set that metric of what is incline, 4%, 5% grade. So you're not looking at overall cycling performance. Now, it is interesting when you go back. I mean, if you want to take a way step back, basically what we're getting at is people who researched cycling are ahead of skiing. So they already went in and started with absolute power, made their connections, and they went, oh, let's go power-weight relationship, made their connections, and then they're like, hey, allometric scaling is more accurately predicting these things, and that's finally where we're at in cycling. And in skiing, we're just like a step behind. You know, first that research was, you gotta have absolute upper body power, you know, that's correlating with ski performance. And then some other people, even looking specifically the double pull technique, it's, you know, advantageous upper body strength or upper body power related to your weight. But people haven't really gone into that third screening where that scaling method of allometric, if we scale strength or power to body weight allometrically, now we have the most accurate predictor of performance. So that's kind of where we're trying to fill in that gap is coming in and saying that. I'm tempted to just like right now, I want to talk about some of these studies in cycling because they are really interesting. But I guess, you know, I'm posted it up there. If you want to take a look, go for it. One thing that kind of was interesting as I was going through the cycling research is I was kind of making connections to Nordic skiing as well, because one of the studies, they took all the different, I think they called them like, I mean, basically they took different body type cyclists. They categorized their pro cycling team into climbers, time trialists, sprinters, all around, you know, which is what a cycling team is. And those morph types are very distinct. The time trial or the uphill climbers are very small, very light, very skinny. The sprinters generally more body mass, as I discussed right away at the beginning of the show, because, the studies have shown that it's more advantageous to be larger and have more power. You know, the threshold of where that becomes inhibitive to performance does not occur in a sprint on the flat. So that body type is there. And then the time trialist is kind of generally larger, but they're unique because in this research had shown that the time trialists really had the overall cycling ability down the best. You know, they could excel in the flats, they could excel in the climbs, and when they were scaling their measurements allometrically, it was like they were coming out on top. And my connection to that, to skiing, and I write about this too, I try to sound all scientific. Let me read you what I wrote here. I said, well, the crossover of these findings is likely obvious to those experienced in Nordic ski racing and research. And sorry, what were those findings? Let me just read that. In discussing these results, this is Padilla in 1999. He notes that during uphill cycling, the submax intensities are often close to lactate threshold and onset of blood lactate accumulation, LT and OBLA, we'll say. And therefore, scaling mechanical power output at these submax intensities may be, quote, necessary to appreciate performance potential during uphill cycling. It was also mentioned that time trial bikers often excel in uphill sections, though field results tend to show uphill cyclists, due to their low body mass, are able to accelerate more efficiently than larger cyclists and thus show the best performance in field tests. In other words, you know, the test is showing the time trial bikers, they can excel in the uphill sections, but what are you seeing in the Tour de France? These uphill cyclists, they're low body mass, they perform better. And I like how he says, though, it's because they're able to accelerate more efficiently. So in a performance or in a race setting, you know, you see everyone's churning and burning up the hill, and then all of a sudden a guy makes a burst, a sudden move. Well, that's where body mass is huge. The acceleration factor is very critical, and they can formulate form a gap, which in cycling is critical to winning. So that makes some sense. But he said time trial bikers, they excel in uphill sections. And the field results are showing the uphill cyclists, due to their low body mass, accelerate and thus do better in the field test. So finally here, getting to the results. Therefore, Padilla concluded that an exponent of 1 as opposed to 0.79 should be used to evaluate uphill cycling ability. But they suggest that the... And this is WLT, so the watts at lactate threshold per kilogram, and then WOBLA, or watts at onset of blood lactate accumulation per kilogram. Those are figures which time trialists and uphill cyclists share in similar values, and could be contributing to their uphill ability. So here's my connection to skiing, okay? I'm ready for this. So exciting. Well, the crossover of these findings is likely obvious to those experienced in Nordic ski racing and research and will be discussed at greater length later. It is worthy of mention in this section as well. In relation to cross-country skiing, where dominant male skiers fit a similar morphotype, that was the word, fit a similar morphotype as time trial cyclists, it is possible that this wattage per kilogram, watt at LT at lactate threshold per kilogram, and wattage at onset of blood lactate per kilogram is another mechanism which could explain why larger skiers excel more so than lighter skiers in long distance classical ski races despite long stretches of uphill double pulling sections, as the majority of these uphill sections within races such as the Visma Classics are raced at those intensities. And then I go on to and talk. So basically, you know, what I'm saying is, like, when you look at skiers who excel in the long Visma Classic races, it's not Chris Froome body types generally, right? They are more of that time trialist morphotype. They are larger and stronger, but it's not so much like a sprinter build. It's a time trial cyclist build. And so my suggestion there is maybe it's not because of the strength to weight relationship. It's more because it's wattage at lactate threshold. It's wattage at onset of blood lactate, because those larger skiers out there, they're not like unfit. And that's not what my argument would be. You know, they have high levels of high lactate thresholds. They are aerobically and anaerobically very fit. So depending on the course, they can really excel. And so I go on to and say, in World Cup sprints and relays, max power, as expressed absolutely, might be more beneficial to performance, as steeper, shorter hills and strategic placement and race strategy require skiers to put out, quote, supra aerobic efforts. I say that in quotes because it is mentioned in other studies, these supra aerobic efforts, wherein they exceed their VO2 power up to 110 to 160%, according to several different studies that I referenced there. So this theory would fall in line with the findings of Padilla in cycling, as he recommends these absolute WMAX values for predicting performance in short events, but WLT and WOBLA in longer time trials and uphill cycling. Okay, so The thing I wanted to kind of bring about there was just kind of the general realization that as we compare these two sports, what we might be finding, at least on the male side, is the best skiers, the morphotype they have is kind of the same as a time trialist in cycling. And so what that means is, you know, to be an all-around exceptional skier, you don't want to become this Chris Froome, Lance Armstrong climbing in the Alps body type that might not be beneficial. And the reason isn't necessarily because the strength to weight relationship is not in your favor. It's because these other elements might be coming into play. WLT per kilogram and WABLA per kilogram. But that's for another researcher to tackle that, because you do need a little more high-tech equipment, I guess, to say. It sounds a little bit like, that sounds too much like a hassle. What we want to look at, essentially, is strength-to-weight relationship in the double pull technique on flats and at incline. So, on the flats, your upper body power is going to be important, obviously, and research has shown that. As we increase the incline, now gravity becomes a little more influential compared to surface area, air resistance, and the friction forces. Gravity is becoming more important. So this is the inspiration where I'm thinking upper body power to strength, and we're going to scale it allometrically because that has been shown in all these other research projects and other sports to be, and we're talking rowing, cycling, other power sports too, not just cycling, but that's been shown to be the best way of doing that as a predictor of success. We want to show that at incline, all right, how much is upper body strength-weight relationship a predictor of double pull performance? And then the other added element that I'm bringing to the picture here is lower body strength-weight relationships. What is the impact of that on the flats in double pull and on inclines, double pull? And the logic behind that is that we're seeing research showing activation increases in the lower body as you increase the incline in the double pull technique. So the thought there is, hey, if you have an advantageous lower body strength to weight relationship, you are going to excel in double pull, and we're going to be able to see that that's a predictor of success. Okay, and why would we do this at all? Let's step way back. Like, why does this even matter for the average athlete? And this is my argument, okay? I think right now in all sports, we struggle with finding a metric or a measurement of our athleticism that is healthy to shoot for. Far too often, we are either thinking, I need to get stronger. And I think as ski coaches, we look at research, we go, upper body power is huge, right? It's huge, it's huge, it's huge. So just get stronger, just get bigger, just get stronger. So is that true? And I would definitely argue that it is not. You know, you can't, there is a threshold, a line where increasing in body mass in order to have an increase in upper body power becomes a disadvantage to you. So we want to search for that threshold, okay? But beyond that, you hear on the one side, people are just looking at the absolute measurement, okay? They want to, and that's going back, right? The first measurement was absolute strength, absolute power. I don't see that as being really super valuable. And as an athlete, I'm not only going to be looking at that. When I'm younger, I maybe do. Like, I just want to increase my bench press from, you know, 180 to 200. I'm not really thinking about my body size, especially when you're growing, right? You're just growing and getting bigger anyway. So you do look at absolute measurements. But now that you're an athlete, you're 25, 30, 35, 40, you're full grown, you need something else. And so now we go to the what I would consider more dangerous, okay? Athletes in training, they are thinking more of metrics such as, I want to lose weight. Well, that's very dangerous, okay? If you're just focusing on weight and equating that with performance, you know, like I weigh 160 pounds now. If I weighed 150, I would predict I'd be a faster runner. That's very dangerous because you're starting to equate a number with performance and that number doesn't equate with performance at all. So, and I think the dangers of that are we know about them. I don't need to elaborate on that. But I think the next one, if you look at strength, let's take strength to weight. Another one I was thinking about too, Chris and I were talking about this, was on our ski, you know, I want to be leaner. And see, to me, that is a much more performance-based target, you know, because now if you're increasing your lean muscle, you can't help but improve your strength-weight relationship. However, if the focus is on leanness, it's very similar to weight, where it's a dangerous one to be hyped up about, because it is possible to become leaner and increase in body mass and improve the strength-weight relationship. And ultimately, what you care about is the performance, which is reflected in the strength-weight relationship measurement, right? It's how much power you're putting out for the body that you have. That's the coolest measurement, because it is directly going to impact performance as a runner, as a biker, as a skier, any of those things, right? It's saying that you're more efficient. So to focus on the power to weight relationship, you will become leaner. Focus on the other one, though, because if you focus on lean, it's a dark, dangerous path that you could lead yourself down. it's really not a laughing matter, because it is serious, you know, and it's a slow thing, but it can become very, very much of a trap. So the motivation here is to give us this metric of training that we can, as athletes, look at and go, I want to improve that. I want to get stronger relative to my body. And that means if that threshold means I can gain 5 pounds, but my overall ratio is improved, then that's good, because that means I will be better. I'll be a better athlete. But being aware of where that threshold is the important part then, you know, because yeah, I think it's risky as a, you know, someone talking about this to kind of just venture off into saying that there, it is possible to be too heavy. You know, that's a very taboo thing we don't want to talk about, but I guess in elite performance, it absolutely is, you know, and Alberto Salazar is kind of getting raked over the coals right now for the things he said about to Mary Kane. And I think like the way he went about that, if we're going to go off a sidetrack here, obviously not condoning that at all, but the actual principle that he was behind, if what I am reading is correct, you know, like just from a sheer scientific standpoint, you can't argue that it's possible to be carrying too much weight in an endurance sport. That's certainly possible. How you go about dealing with it is one thing. So, and that's actually, I think, what this study could help, is a healthy metric. Because finally, the thing that I think is scary is people look at, okay, I see what you're saying, strength weight relationships. So how do I improve that? And a lot of times the first thing people think is, well, I'm going to try and lose 5 pounds, you know, cause that changes the metric there. And this is what we see in cycling all the time. Cycling directors, you know, restricting food from their athletes, and being just very, it's disturbing, that world that exists. And what I would say is that's like a quick fix, but it's not long-term, and it also is so much more risky than looking the other way, which would be improving strength, that it's not worth going down at all by any means. So as a coach or an athlete, I don't think if we idealize this, you know, let's say the study is done and we really find some great findings, and it comes to show that there really is a connection between the ratio and performance. My encouragement to athletes and coaches would be, okay, here's what you got to do now is you want to train functionally and you want to improve your functional strength first, then go back and do some of these tests and see where you're at. And then if you're, you know, I guess someone could ask, well, what happens then if you've improved your absolute strength, but this ratio's off? You know, what would you say to that athlete? Then you go back and say, hey, now you got to cut weight. I would say no. I would say you got to go back to what you did in training to improve this. Like, were you emphasizing the increasing, were you emphasizing, was your training plan set up to build too much mass and not to build necessarily power or explosion? Right? Because look at a guy like Mo Farah. He does not have mass, but he can squat like twice his body weight, right? And that's because he's training much more for explosive power. And it would be nice if we could do this study, by the way, and do power, not strength. But I'm going to get to that in a second of why we are choosing to look at strength instead of power. But I will say, in the case of an athlete who comes and has that issue, I would say you might need to focus more on power, explosiveness. Now you need to get those the neurological training up. You need to do more plyometrics. You, like, your neurons need to be firing more. Don't worry about increasing muscle fiber mass because you might have too much of that, right? And looking at the training more than going, all right, it's time to reduce calories or something. That should pretty much never be something you're doing with an athlete. Okay, a little bit of rant. So why strength weight instead of power? So this comes down to a little bit of a feasibility. Again, I want to bring this to the general public. So it'd be great if I could do a test and have people, we could measure their double pulling power with some really high-tech power meters, get those readings, and then do a performance test, you know, and get everything sent out. And that we'd be looking at, and we'd come to a conclusion that, yep, you got to increase your power relative to your body mass because that's going to help you on inclines and double pull. And nope, we kind of hypothesized on the flat. It looks like an increase in body mass doesn't really impact it. You know, in fact, the larger skiers are an advantage, and that's what, you know, we would hypothesize because that's what the previous research has shown. And we come to those, we draw those conclusions. The problem there is, okay, so what about, you know, the Bagley High School team? Like, they don't have access to power meters that are placed into poles, right? But they could definitely run these strength tests we're going to do, right? The seated lat down pull, right? And that's simulating that. We can measure that, a squat, those types of things. So what I want to do is run these litany of strength tests, which are doable by pretty much anyone, that are also very, very double pull specific, and then make the connections to double pull at incline, double pull on the flats. All right. And if you are in any doubt about, well, why double pull is really not that big a deal, might I have the great Bjorn Dahle enlighten you here with this clip?
See, here we have with the hero, Bjorn Dahle, and no further introduction needed. Yesterday, we had a race here, 15-kilometer classic race, and three in top 10 double pulled the entire course. Yeah, what do you think about it? Because you were one of the best double pullers in the world.
Oh, yeah, I think it was interesting to see that it was possible to do it in Davos because of the altitude and the hard track. Yeah, I would have never thought about that in my days. So, and I think maybe it's because of a little bit of the conditions. It was a blister and some not so good glide, so it was a little bit problematic, so maybe that did it possible, actually.
Do we have a chance that this is going to be doing more and more, that people are focusing on double pole in most races? Is classic skiing history?
I don't hope so. And I don't think it's any good idea that it doesn't look good to go around double pulling. So then the point of two techniques are, in a way, gone.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Certainly the racers are stronger than before in their muscles, and special training for double pulling gives results.
Yes. And what are you doing here now besides enjoying the skiing? Are you working with the ski team in Norway? Or?
Yeah, I'm developing clothes for with the Norwegian ski team. We are the main sponsor with both the US and the Norwegian.
As a matter of fact, I do sell in my Finsisu shop, Bjørn Dahle clothing. So,
so I'm doing product development and being a little bit around with the teams and so on. And I have my children's race here in Davos. We have had it for over 10 years now. So it's good to be back in fantastic surroundings like Davos. It's a fantastic place.
Thank you very much, Bjorn.
So yeah, double pulling is important, and it's very relevant on pretty much all courses. I mean, I watch the World Cup, and I know they're trying to do a lot with course construction to make it so skiers have to classic stride. But what I'm kind of seeing is happening now is skiers are double pulling when they can, and then pretty much herringbone or sprinting. They're kind of doing the clobo, right? Like, there's not really a whole lot of elegant sections of that old school stride technique, except I will say the Russians tend to do that a little more. They have that really stretched out old school Russian school technique of classic striding, long strides, reaching out in front, reaching high with the arms. If you watch some videos of the Russians doing dry land drills, you'll know what I'm saying. And then if you watch Bolshinov classic stride, you can see the connection. And the Norwegian classic stride from guys like Klabo, it's really graceful and beautiful, right? But the thing that strikes me is how athletic the position of their body is. Like the actual stance, if you just stopped them at any point in their stride, they're in a very athletic posture. And that's much, much newer. And you see that in the coaching when you go through our L100 or L200 stuff, they talk a lot about your posture and your athletic stance and how everything kind of starts from there. The Norwegians really have that down. And that's what I think allows them to explode when they're classic striding. Very, very quick changes of speed. But anyway, is double pull irrelevant? It's obviously very relevant. And in the Vismas, you know, you're looking at 99% of the course is double pulled by everyone who's in the top 200. You know, the males, it's extremely rare if they ever even use a ski with kick wax. On the female side, even now, it's the proportions are, you know, there are a lot of striders, but there's a few that are just like, no, I'm just going to double pull just like the guys do. And those courses are built a little more Leadvillian-like, mineral belt, 4% grade, nothing too crazy. But on the World Cup, you know, they've got very steep ups and very steep downs. So, I don't know. I kind of wonder if some people, the purists, like, where do I fall on this line? This is something I should think about for my next podcast, you know, like what I think about it. I guess I'll give you my quick take is I actually think double pulling is kind of an elegant motion. I don't see it as this brute, it's still elegant and it's still aerobic, obviously. And good double pullers are not necessarily huge, stocky people. I think that's something to remember, and it's something this study could show. But, you know, and Bjorn Dahle wasn't necessarily, he wasn't like, you know, insanely buff either. He could run an 808 3K. So he was fast. He had some runner build to him. But anyway, I believe the double pull as a technique is elegant. So I'm kind of fine with people not doing anything, taking that kind of hands-off capitalist approach. Let skiers innovate. Let competition drive them to innovation. And that's what we've let happen so far. And things like striding zones, to me, are... I don't know if they're really effective in preserving the purest approach anyway, the guys who want, like, I want to keep, you know, some striding in here, because for one thing, sometimes those sections are so steep that, you know, at that point in a race, a skier might be double pulling up to it and then just like herringboning up it, right? They're not like choosing to stride on it. So what I actually think is if you're going to make a hands-on approach and go, no, we're going to keep striding in the game, I think they should make those sections on really random spots of the course. You know, like maybe put a striding section where it's 0% grade. You know, like now they have to have really good striding technique. Put a striding zone on a gradual uphill where you would easily double pull. And if you want, you can still put on a really steep one too. But they should have different sections at different grades, because I think that would really test a person's true ability to classic stride as well. So if you want to do it that way, you could go that way. Otherwise, you know, I think it was the interview that, you know, are we going to just have a completely different event altogether? I mean, you could do that, but I think that's really throwing something in the face of the skiers who are like the Bill Kochs who like innovate, you know, I mean, which I guess that is kind of what they did with it. You know, we're going to create a whole new discipline, skating. But if you go, we're now going to have double pulling, striding, and skating. Basically, what you're saying is those of you who decided to, you know, let winning and losing drive your training and competition drive your training and performance drive your training, which is what it should. We're going to respond to you by creating a completely new event. So sorry. You know, I don't think that's really fair to innovators. You know, if you innovate and you come up with something and you develop a skill and it's within the rules, the original rules, I mean, don't you leave it there? Now, I guess you could argue, what about basketball? You know, the free throw and Wilt Chamberlain's dunking, you know, we got to change it up there, or things like that. But, So I guess I could play devil's advocate and understand that point of view as well. But I think the healthy medium would be stride zones and put them at random spots. And then also design your courses so that, and this is what they are doing this, you know, to try and help people who are good at stride technique. But But see, I think athletes are just going to respond to that by going, oh, you don't think I can develop that much upper body power? You don't think I can be that good at double pulling? You just watch, you know, and then they do this. Or they're like Klaba. It's like, hey, I think it's more advantageous to just simply run up this hill. Like, that was a long time coming, right? I mean, if you're a really fit skier, it makes total sense to absolutely do a, quote, super aerobic effort, right? And just sprint up a hill, you know, at that speed. Don't even worry about grace and technique and looks. Just like, just hammer it because you're going to recover on the downhill. And so he's really, I think that's neat that he's done that. I'm not a fan of the actual, the Klabo, so to, you know, sprinting up the hill. I don't like it. But again, I have to kind of, to be consistent, I have to go, well, he's an innovator. Like, it works for him, you know, good for him. So what can we do to make that either so it's not really going to work super well if we really want to be purist and preserve the sport in this one way or whatever. But that's another interesting topic we could dive into. But I don't want to go too far here because keeping the podcast a little bit shorter, hopefully that'll reel in some more listeners. So I think we'll just kind of close up there. We talked some science of sport. Coming up on our next show, hoping to look into another study. Obviously, we'll do some question and answer responses to emails and things from this one. Also kind of want to look at a discussion I've heard on the radio on a podcast I listen to. They're arguing about what the hardest sport is, and it was just super frustrating to listen to. For one, they just didn't have any metric for what they were going to grade these on. So I'm hoping to put up an article, like, what is actually the hardest sport? We're going to grade it out, and we'll talk about where Nordic skiing fits in there. We're also on the podcast going to do a little race reviews, a couple of those. And I might have another book review, too, to talk about. So there. How ambiguous was that? We learned in radio school how to lure listeners back, right? You need a good tease to bring them back. That was an excellent tease. We might talk about this, and we might talk about that, and we might even do this. Anyway, hope you enjoyed it. Hope you learned something. The snow is still heavy out here in Leadville, so sorry because you can't travel here, but we're going to keep skiing as long as we can, and maybe that makes you jealous. Sorry about that. But hopefully you are staying safe and healthy where you are.